再练练。
Hello everyone, my name is Reese, I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to say happy birthday to Kat and Bill. I was so glad that I got to share your birthday with you. And welcome to all the newcomers. I'm really glad you're here, and I hope you've heard something tonight that will help you to want to come back. Mark, he said it all. You said it all. You know, I was telling him it's a tough act to follow. I love to laugh in these rooms, and I'm sure new people or people who are just visiting, or they come in and they hear us laugh at what we're laughing at, and they probably think we're crazy. Because I try to put myself, like, I have some family members here tonight from Washington, D.C., and I don't know if they caught the beginning part of the meeting, but I was kind of trying to put myself in their shoes. And I had an aunt a long time ago, same thing. She wasn't an alcoholic, and she was mortified at the things that we laugh at in here. But, you know, I need to be able to laugh at my disease today. I need to be able to say, you are not bigger than God. You are not bigger than God. And so, Mark, thank you so much. I'm really glad you were my first, or this 10-minute speaker. So I like to go way back. What happened and what it's like now. What it was like, I like to start from the years way before I started drinking and using. Using is definitely part of my story, too. Because it was my thinking processes and the way I thought about myself, about the world, the way I felt about myself and the world, which got me to drinking in the first place. And, you know, and I had a lot of alcoholic behavior before I ever had my first drink. I was full alcoholic, very young, didn't know it. I believe that. That's my opinion, and I totally believe that. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, from a single mother, and I had an older brother. He was 3 years older than me. And, you know, my perception of those early years is entirely different than my brother's. A few years ago, we were talking about our childhood, and he was, you know, recounting a lot of his fun experiences, and I looked at him, and I told him, I don't remember that. And I was telling him my experiences, and he looks at me like I'm nuts, and he says, you know, are you sure we grew up under the same roof? Because my perception is skewed. I look at life as harsh and dark and mean, and like everybody's out to get me because, you know, it's all about me, and I'm not good enough. I'm young. I'm 5, and I'm not good enough. Where does that come from? Where does it come from? So I'm young, and I have this mom who suffers from chronic migraines and depression. And so I remember our house being very dark and having to be very quiet and having to be careful. Didn't want mom to be sick. And so my early years were all about helping mom not be sick. Because I remember her being in her room and sobbing, and the shades are drawn, and you have to be quiet because migraines are gnarly and they need dark and they need quiet. And that was really hard, you know, because very early I learned that I didn't want to be a girl. That was my example. I did not want to be a girl. I did not want to be like my mother. And I love my mother, but that's not what I wanted to be. So my brother, he was my role model. And my brother, you know, he's typical older brother with a younger sister. He does what all you guys do who have younger siblings. Very mean. And you know, you're not as smart as me, you're not as fast as me, you're not as good as me. And the budding alcoholic that I am, take all of this to heart. I believe what he says to be truth, and so I try even harder to be just like him. You know, we played games of smear the queer with his friends, and I would deliberately get the ball and let him tackle me and be tough and not cry because I want to be just like my brother, and I want to be accepted, and I want to be a boy. I knew I was screwed. I'm not a boy. But boy, did I try. Very, very tough little girl. And by the time I'm 9 years old, you know, I have all my brother's hand-me-down tough skins. Do you guys remember the tough skins? You know, they're like 3 times the thickness of a regular pair of jeans, and they can stand up on their own. And I was proud of my tough skins, you know, and I was tough. Well, my dad is old school Hispanic. And I'd only seen him a couple times over the years. And one day my mom decides to go visit him in Irvine, California. And this is kind of how my mom operated. She comes back 2 weeks later and she says, we're moving back with my father. Now, she left him when I was 3 months old. I barely knew the man. And so we pack up and we're off to Irvine, California. Now, at the time, Irvine was all white. And I never thought in terms of race before, because in Seattle it was pretty much, even at that time, a melting pot. Nobody thought about race. We're in this all-white community, and I have this very Hispanic father, and all of a sudden we're being called names, and all of a sudden I'm resenting the hell out of his black Cadillac and his three-piece suits, and I don't want to be seen with him. Yet I want him to love me. I want to be accepted. Yet he's having a really hard time because I'm not the proper little girl that he would have raised, who is to be seen and not heard and very docile and, you know, all that stuff. That wasn't me. I was loud and obnoxious and I fought with my brother and I didn't know how to be anybody else. I didn't want to be anybody else, but I wanted this person to love me. And it was extremely difficult during those years. And I knew, again, it was a reinforcement of, I'm not good enough. Why can't I just be who I am? I'm not good enough. So by the time I'm 13, Mom one day comes in the room and she says, we're moving back to Seattle without your father. And so, you know, I'm pissed. I think it's my fault. Because I couldn't get along with Dad. It's my fault. We're leaving because of me. And Mom goes back to Seattle and she looks for a job and she leaves me there with my father and my brother for a month. And I did not see him during that month except when he left money on the table so I could eat. And my brother was, I don't know where he was. And I had a half-sister. Now, you know, I say all this stuff because it's this kind of stuff, the things that make me feel less than, the things that make me feel not good enough, that will get me back out there. I don't care how much time I have. If I can still think about this stuff today and be affected, I can still think I'm not good enough. So I like to remember this stuff because this is what created the person that I am. So I'm out there and I'm in this apartment and I'm by myself and I can remember curling up in the corner of my mom's bedroom, sobbing, talking to her in Seattle, saying, I don't know where he is. He won't let me go with him. This half-sister who's 2 years younger, they would leave money and then they'd walk off holding hands and I'd run after him. Can I go? Where are you going? Why can't I go? And they wouldn't even turn around. And so by the time, I'm 13, very scary age anyway for a young lady. Well, tomboy lady. So we moved back to Seattle. And the only place my mom can afford at this time, this is just so funny when I think back all this stuff, is a place in the south end of Seattle. And the south end of Seattle is primarily black and Hispanic. And, you know, I'm blonde, but I'm thinking I am totally, you know, I'm ethnic, I'm different, because that's the way I was treated in white bread Irvine. And I'm in Seattle, and now I'm Goldilocks, and I'm white girl, and I'm, again, the outcast, and I'm pissed. I am pissed. I hate everyone. I don't know where I fit. At this point, I don't even want to fit. I don't want you to look at me. I don't want anything to do with you. And the thing is, at the time, the one thing that got me through all these years was school. I was really good student in school. I thrive in school. I was a straight-A student. It was my only link to sanity. You know, at school, I was the perfect student. I didn't speak out. I was very quiet. I was a loner. At home, it was an entirely different story. Because not long after that, after we moved back to Seattle, I discovered my first drink. And it wasn't alcohol. It was not alcohol that gave me my first escape. It was rage. Rage. I don't know how it happened. Something happened one day, and I just lost my mind. And oh my gosh, I had never felt so incredible. I had never felt so empowered. I didn't give a damn if my mom got sick. I didn't give a damn who I hit, who hit me, what I broke. It didn't matter. I was lost and I felt just incredible. And so that was my first drink. That was my first taste of escape from who I didn't want to be. I couldn't stand myself. I just wanted to be away from me, and that rage got me there. After a few years, you know, I discovered my second drink, which is boys. And, you know, in this house that I grew up in, I know my mom loved me. I know she did the best she could. But my mom didn't know how to hold me. She didn't know how to, she didn't know how to touch me. She didn't know how to give me physical affection. And so I discovered boys, and oh my gosh, the affection, the love I didn't know I was missing was all of a sudden right there, and it took me away from me. I got lost in it. It was great. My first boyfriend, I moved out at 15, and, you know, I managed to graduate from high school. But 4 years later, by the time we split up, I discovered that all that fighting I'd done with my brother that I thought was normal, you know, he'd call my mom up, "Mom, I think I killed her this time as I'm coming to," and I'd be so excited. He cares. He cares. So this boyfriend that I'm with at the end of 4 years, I finally realized that the violence that's happening probably isn't normal. But, you know, I thought that violence was just part of a relationship because that was my role model. That's what I had at home with my brother. And so when I, at the end of this 4 years, and I leave this relationship, and I am so destroyed inside. I hadn't had my first real drink. I needed one so bad. By this time, I knew my brother drank in high school, and I told myself, I am never going to do that. He smoked pot. I'm like, you look like an idiot. Why would anyone want to do that? I remember helping him clean up after getting sick in the bathroom in the middle of the night, and I didn't want my mom to find out. And I'm like, why would anybody want to do that? Why would anyone want to do that? So I did not have my first real drink until I was almost 19. And it's funny. So I leave this person. I'm needing to be away from me so desperately, not knowing what I need to do it. So, of course, I run to the arms of the first person who's nice to me, and his name is Smiley. I mean, come on. His name is Smiley. And he did. He smiled all the time, and he was a cholo. And I thought, oh, maybe this is where I fit in. He's a cholo. All of a sudden, I start talking like this, you know. Tony Montana became my friend. And so I was with this, and he was part of a lowrider gang, you know. And we had the coolest cars, and we'd go to these car shows. And everybody, you know, they kind of stand, you know, we stood really cool. We danced really cool. You know that Lean Like a Cholo song? That's very accurate. It's a whole persona, and I ate it up. I loved it. I loved how I felt, and I just wanted to belong. It wasn't long after, a few months, I don't know, I kind of realized that they kept different hours than I did, you know, right when I'm going to bed. They're just kind of getting up and getting started, and I was very naive with the whole drug scene and all that and the alcohol. And so one night we were at a party, and they were passing this thing around and holding up to their nose, and one of the girls was like, you know, you got to try this. You'll dance better. You'll feel better. It'll just be better. And then I did, and you know, and that's not what I noticed. With cocaine, what I noticed was all the feelings I felt about myself and the world, all the thoughts I had in my mind about me and the world were gone. Numb. Gone. Obliterated. I was totally indifferent to everything. And I loved it. I'm like, I want more of this. Well, it just so happened that Smiley was the local drug dealer. I didn't know that before at this point. I was like, you know, I'm doing good. So at this point, I'm drinking Long Island iced teas, we're going to car shows, we're doing all this. But at the end of 2 years, I was done. Burnout. I'd gone to the places Mark went to, the paranoia in my mind, and I drank Long Island iced teas so much I couldn't drink them anymore. I went through the substitution thing with alcohol, and nothing was working. What happened is I feel like my alcoholism was speeding up. It needed more. It needed more. It needed it now. It wasn't working well enough. So I left Smiley. It's all your fault. It's all everybody's fault. I'm the way I am. I can't stand me. I can't stand you. I'm so messed up, and I just want it all to stop. I want the voices to stop. I want the feelings to stop, because, you know, life is way too extreme. Life is so extreme. I feel so much, and I always say that I believe as an alcoholic, at least this alcoholic, that's my problem, is I feel everything too much.
Unfortunately, it's the negative stuff. That's what I feel too much. And so I leave smiling, and I go back home, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to do the right thing. I start college, and I'm doing well in college, but you know, that feeling, that restlessness, that searching, that the voices are back because I no longer have things to numb them, and I'm really trying to do the right thing, and I don't want to be messed up, but I'm already messed up, and I need something to fix me now. So what happens, you know, I have Mom Moon, and he's the preppy white boy with the little sports car. You see a pattern here. That was Elliot. And Mamoon was the African who smoked spliffs, which is an entirely different scene. I liked it. They were very mellow. And we ate a lot. And we laughed a lot. And life was very simple. But you know, my alcoholism, it's not enough. It's not enough. You need more. My disease is all over me. It's trying to kill me. And I believe that. I remember when I finally got sober this last time, it dawned on me one day, oh my gosh, there is a part of me that wants me dead. Like, there is a part of me inside of me that wants to kill me. And that was the most bizarre epiphany. And you know, it's true. It sucks, but it's true. I believe that. Left to my own devices, this part of me will insidiously insert itself into my brain, into my feelings, until I can't stand myself enough that I'm going to go out and drink and die. So anyway, Elliot and Mamoon, and then it dawned on me one day, I know what the problem is. It's the guy's fault. It's all your fault. You don't understand me. Nothing, you know. So yes, and of course, good alcoholic that I am, I found her. Her name was Eva Ruma, and she was from Venezuela. Now, as you see, I'm each time I try to pick someone totally different from the one before, because I think, you can fix me. You're going to make me okay. I just need to pick the right person. I don't know this consciously, but looking back, that has to be the case. And the fact that we're just crazy. So Eva Ruma from Venezuela, and she was in the Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle. And the Pike Place Market is a cool place where all the artists hang out, all the street musicians, you know, people drink and they do a little stuff, but everybody's cool. So there she was, and she painted her hats cool colors and her guitars, and she was extremely talented. Everybody loved her, and that became my girlfriend. And within 3 weeks, I lost my job. I stopped going to college. I was kicked out of my house, and I was living on the streets of Seattle because Eva Ruma from Venezuela was probably the worst messed up person I'd been with up until that point. But by this point, the disease had me. The disease had me, and the disease said, you are having fun. You are living the life. It's just like the movies. Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. And so I believed it. My mom says, and I don't remember, she said I would write her notes or letter. I don't even know how they got there, but she said, you actually said those things, that you were having a good time. And I look back now, and you know, I don't have the rose-colored glasses. I don't have that glamorizing, oh yeah, it was awesome being out there, because what I remember is entirely different now. And I think that's God reminding me of where my disease really took me. The disease wants to tell me, oh, don't you remember all the fun times? But man, no. It's not about that. Because honestly, it became all about feeding the monster on my back. Feeding the monster on my back, keeping me so far away from me that I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I didn't feel. That's all I wanted to do. That's all the disease had me doing. I was a puppet. I did what my disease wanted me to do, and I didn't know that until I got sober. I really believed I was free. That is denial. That is just denial. I believed I was free, but every conscious moment I had was, how do I get enough alcohol and enough drugs to keep me obliterated? How do I do that? And I did whatever I could to be obliterated. And you know what happened, and I know this is, I'm supposed to speak in a general way, but I like to be honest and gritty, because this is what alcoholism does. This is what it did to me. It put me on Skid Row to where I was asking the winos for a sip of their drink. It put me in the gutter looking for cigarette butts because I didn't have any cigarettes. It put me under trees. I can remember I was up for weeks moving, as we do when we're up for weeks, because the world undulates when you're up for weeks. In case you didn't know that, you don't need to. I can remember crawling under bushes, trying not to let anybody see where I was going so I could pass out for 2 or 3 days, and I didn't want anything to happen to my body when I wasn't present. That's where it took me. I can remember sleeping on a cardboard box under a tree. You know, it's Seattle. It's cold and it's wet. Just trying to stay warm, and I traded my jacket for a hit of crack, you know, for a bottle of Old English 800. So that's where I was. That's where my disease took me. I was pregnant a couple times out there. The first time, I had a miscarriage. And I can remember being so pissed off. I'm in the doorway, and all I can is blood. I'm covered in blood, and all I can think of is, damn, I can't get loaded now because I have to go to the hospital. That's where my disease took me. That's where alcoholism took me. And the second time I was pregnant, I was in the hospital, and I was dealing drugs out of my hospital bed. I was there for a week. I had a miscarriage. A stillborn baby, a boy. And I didn't care. I did not care. I was so addicted to the life. I knew nothing else by this point. Everything that I had been, everything, any glimmer of hope in my life had been long extinguished. I was gone. And as long as drugs and alcohol kept me gone, I was in their grip. That's all I cared about. The miracle happened when I was, I can't remember exactly when it was, but the miracle, it's so incredible when I think about now, is I can remember having my 40 ounce of Old English 800, my pack of Newport cigarettes, and my crack pipe. And I can remember being in an alley, and I had them all laid out in front of me, thinking, I'm going to ingest all this stuff, and I'm still going to feel. Something happened to where I couldn't get lost anymore. And what a blessing. At the time, all I wanted to do was die. It didn't matter how much I drank, didn't matter how much I used, I was still present. I couldn't escape me. And that is the most desperate, it is the worst place in the world, and it is the best place in the world because it gave me the opportunity to get sober finally. I don't know how long I lived in that state because all I wanted to do was die. I had tried committing suicide several times, seriously. I had been in and out of jail. I'd been in and out of psych wards. I'd been in and out of treatment centers. I'd been in and out of everything that we're in and out of many, many times. Couldn't get it. And towards the end here, when that happened, that was the miracle. But it's funny how it ended up really happening. So here's... Okay, so the last place I went to get sober. This is where I have to be honest, right? I didn't exactly go there to get sober. I went there to get away from the big guy who had just smoked all his drugs. And I knew he wouldn't look for me in a recovery home. And that was the case. And I went into the recovery home and I was out of my mind, paranoid, scared, all that stuff that we are. And I remember asking the counselor, is there someplace I can go out of the state? Because I was so scared of this person. So after that program was completed, I went down to Palm Springs, California, because I'd heard, now you know how this brain works by now, I'd heard that Palm Springs, California was where all the movie stars were, and it was glitzy, and it was glamorous, and so that's where I went. Within 2 weeks, I found out I was pregnant with that guy's baby. But another miracle happened when I was there. You know, I stepped off the plane. At this time, it was the middle of August. And I'd never been, you know, in anything like, okay, you guys know where I'm going. And I can remember walking across the pavement with the only thing I own, this duffel bag full of everything that I have inside it. And I have my combat boots. Remember, I'm still tough. My baseball hat on backwards, my baggy jeans, and I'm trying to be so cool. I'm trying to be cool because it's the last thing I have. Walking across the pavement, knowing I'd finally entered hell because the pavement moved. When it's 120 degrees out, the pavement moves. And I thought, I've finally entered hell. I've and I'm sober. So I end up going up to Desert Hot Springs. And as we're driving up there, because my mom had paid for a month in a sober living, you know, there's a tumbleweed that goes by on the street, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? So within 2 weeks, I get kicked out, of course, because I can't follow the rules, and I'm crazy. Okay, it's a miracle that any one of us stays sober in the beginning, especially. Not only do I have the crazy thoughts and feelings that got me to drink and use in the first place, I have all the wreckage that I created during that time, along with the repressed feelings from all those years of being out there on the street, and now I have nothing. I am raw. I am raw. I'm crazy. I am in the middle of the street in Desert Hot Springs with my duffel bag, 120 degrees, pregnant. Don't know anybody. This is where the other miracle happened. You know, I'd been in and out of meetings and everything. I never believed a word you said. And you guys made me sick. You know, and so here I was, and something dawned on me. It was God, I believe today. I had $100 in my pocket that my mom had given me. And for the first time in my life since I'd started drinking and using, that did not translate into how many drugs and how much alcohol can I. It would just stayed money. The second miracle happened. It said, go to a meeting. A meeting? Somehow I found myself in a meeting, and you know, and I'm sweating and I'm pissed and I don't know where I am. I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. And this happened. And I swear it wasn't me. I didn't raise my hand. And all of a sudden, I am vomiting on you. Everything about what's happening. I'm crying. I don't know the last time I cried. I was a mess. And so, of course, when I was done, I was mortified. Those feelings and thoughts descended on me, and I went outside and sat, and I was just so mortified that I had been so honest with you, and you guys were going to, you know, of course, you guys, after the meeting, you came, thanks for sharing, and we're so glad you're here, and keep coming back, and you know, and for the first time in my life, I don't know why, my heart was open enough to believe you, and to hear you. For those moments, I let you in. For the first time in my life, I let you in. And it saved my life because it allowed me to get direction from you, to tell me where I could go and have this baby, which was in Indio, California, at the ABC Club. The ABC Club in Indio. And I remember I went there and I hated it. I don't, you know, alcohol, we don't like being told what to do. We don't like following rules. And in a recovery home, if they're any good, they have you doing something from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep. Because we can't be alone in our head. We can't have any spare moment to think, to allow the disease to plot our next demise. So I'm in this recovery home, and I'm there, and I'm at 6 months pregnant. My water breaks in the TV room. And I know it's too soon. Now, that was the other thing that happened is when I got down to the desert, I felt like God had forgiven me by blessing me with another child. And I knew I had to have this child. Now, even though I didn't know how to live life, even though I didn't love me, even though I didn't like anyone, I knew that I had to have this baby. So at 6 months, 25 weeks, when my water broke, I was like, now what am I going to do? What am I going to do? It's too soon. It's too soon. And so I got rushed up to Loma Linda, the teaching hospital up there, and they had an amazing neonatal unit. And my daughter was born at 1 pound, 7 ounces. And she was there for 4 months. And during that time, I have to tell you, it was touch and go. They didn't know if she was going to live. She'd gain an ounce over the loudspeaker at the recovery home. They'd say, tubes coming out of everywhere. And I'm like, how can I possibly take care of this little baby? I can't even take care of me. And then I'd ask God to help me, you know. And it was just a roller coaster. And finally, the director of the ABC Club got tired of me being threatening the other residents with violence because, you know, I'm 8 months, I don't know how many months, so, but I haven't changed. I just don't want to drink. And that was the weird thing, is I was scared to death. Oh, this was the first thing. My first surrender was not to God. It was to my disease. It was, okay, I give up. You're bigger than me. I can't control you. You win. And that's what allowed my surrender to God. That's what allowed God in. So how much time do I have? So I'm sober. I am sober. And I have this little baby and I'm kicked out of the ABC club. I didn't drink. And within a few days, I called them up and I could go get my baby. And you know, what a miracle. This baby is 18 years old today. I just celebrated 19 years sober last month. And I am here to tell you that we are all miracles. If we're sitting here tonight on a Saturday, sober, listening to another alcoholic tell their story, that's a miracle. That we are willing to get out of our own heads for a minute and listen to someone else. So, you know, I had this baby and I'm crazy. I'm crazy. I'm sober. I'm a tomboy. I don't know how to be a girl. I still don't like being a girl. Don't want to be a girl. Yet I see all these women that like, oh, I wish I could be like that. I wish I could be like that. But how do I get from here to there? You know, I don't know how to do it. And I'll be damned if I go up to you and ask you. And I'm keeping you away. And you guys are loving me in spite of myself. You guys are loving me. You're hugging me. And I start to warm up. I start to thaw a little bit. I start working the steps with a sponsor. I'm going to meetings every single day. I live in a sober place. I rent a room from a sober woman. And I am doing the deal with this little baby. And if it wasn't for you people in these rooms that taught me how to be a parent, I don't know if she'd be alive today. No, I'm not kidding. I'd go to a meeting and she knew everyone. She'd run to everyone. Everybody'd hold her. She got all the love from you people because I didn't know how to do that very well. I didn't know how to love my baby very well. And, you know, I told myself that I need to hold her. I need to touch her. I need to rock her. And so I did those things and I would read to her and I started to learn how to be a mother from you people. I watched you people. And so the years passed. I was on welfare at this time. This baby was very sickly. I had to, you know, nurture her and make her healthy enough so I could finally get a career besides the one, you know, all the illegal things that I used to do. So I went to cosmetology school because I figured maybe there they can teach me how to be a lady. And I went there and you know, I completed that program. And a year later, I went and I got my license. And I became self-supporting, and it's been incredible. You know, I had an apartment for the first time in my life that was my own. I didn't have my first car till I was like 27 years old, but it was a lemon, but it was mine. It was my car. And I started getting the outside stuff together a little bit, you know. The thing that I still suffered from that I thought was going to drive me crazy, though, was the rage. It took years for me to stop hitting boyfriends, throwing things. I graduated to throwing things, and then it became just yelling. But it took years. Thank God I did not abuse my child like that. But she saw a lot of stuff. And so, you know, I'm doing better, and I'm starting to thaw, and I'm starting to become a woman, and I'm starting to learn how to have. I have a lot of sponsees. I'm tight with my sponsor. She told me, "You have a sponsee on one side and me on the other, and you're safe," because you know when you hang out at the edge of the herd, the wolves of addiction and alcoholism can pick you off. And so I'm in the middle of the herd, and I'm doing the deal, and the years are passing, and my life is getting amazing. You know, that father who couldn't accept me, that I spent years trying to get to accept me and trying to get him to love me, it was the one piece of my puzzle that I could. I'd made amends with my family. I was good with my mom, and this father, he wouldn't see me. For my first 8 years of sobriety, he was ashamed. He was embarrassed I couldn't handle my drinking. He was ashamed that I had a black child. He was ashamed of me. And I remember one time I was on a women's cruise, and we went down to Ensenada, and one of my friends, it was a sobriety cruise, one of my friends said, "Well, are you going to see your dad?" Because I'd heard he'd moved down there. And I'm like, "I have nothing to say to that man." And they're like, "Ooh, it looks like you need to make an amends." And I was like, "Excuse me, I have done nothing to this man. He's done, you know, all these things." And she told me the most profound thing. She said, "The amends isn't for him, Reese. It's for you. It's for you. It's to give you freedom. It's to give you peace of mind." And I went down there and I looked up this man, and he started making excuses again. And my friend was right there to coach me through that whole conversation. And I was able to be humble, and I was able to see my dad for the first time in many, many years and apologize to him for I don't really know what. But it didn't matter, because what happened is he apologized to me. He apologized to me. And, you know, he was diagnosed not long after with liver cancer, and he had cirrhosis of the liver, and he had hepatitis because of his drinking. And if it wasn't for 8 years of sobriety, I would never have been able to love this man, forgive this man, and be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 8 months of his life. That is why you have to stick around. For me, it's been a very slow road. But I'm telling you, the miracles happen. Some of the biggest miracles happen if you just hold on to your seat and you don't leave. It took 8 years. But those last 8 months of my dad's life, I was able to go down to Ensenada almost every weekend and give him love. Give him what you guys had given me unconditionally. Just love him. I had no resentment towards him anymore. I had no negativity. All I had was love. And he came to my home group and at the ABC Club to actually present me with my 8-year token before he passed away. And the whole room erupted because everybody knew the story. And he told me after that meeting, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you. And I wish I would have found this many years ago. So that's my story. Today, wow, I'm a straight-A student, of course. Straight student. I'm working on a psychology degree. You know, I want to be a motivational speaker. I've written a book. My daughter is 120 days sober. Yes, she's one of us. I'm going to be getting ready to buy my house in the next few months, my first place to live. I am a very successful hairstylist, and I'm proud to be a woman. Thank you.